Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from EveryoneLovesGuitar.com. Real quick announcement before we bring on today's awesome guest is by the time you're listening to this, we're up in the 80s. Just love to get some feedback from everybody one way or another, what you like, what you don't like, good, bad, or ugly. Hopefully there's a lot more good than bad and ugly, but please be candid and let me know. I've got big shoulders, and my goal is just to make this the best podcast possible. So I'd love to hear your feedback. Just let me know. Either hop on our Facebook page at facebook.com/everyoneloves guitar or go to our website, everyoneloves guitar.com, and you see how to get a hold of me. That being said, I've got one of the nicest and most prolific artists I've ever had on the show. We're with Shay Watson today. Shay's a singer-songwriter out of Nashville and multi-instrumentalist, actually, which is important, as you'll see. He spends most of his time today working in the sync industry, and this means he's creating songs on request, like basically on demand, to get played in Hollywood movies, television shows, and other commercials. This is a really interesting business because literally people will call him and his partner up and say, we need something to sound like that, to sound like this, and they'll give him an example, and they'll give them the context under which the song has to be played in, and, you know, that's pretty vague, and they have to turn that around and write, produce, play, engineer, master, and do all the instruments on the song, and they do that two or three songs a day. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So you talk about the hardest working guys in show business. These are it. Shay's written songs for bands and solo artists such as world recording artists, Sidewalk Prophets, Grammy nominees, Sonic Flood, Grammy winning DC Talks and Newsboys, Michael Tate, his own duo, Watson and Nash, and James Clay, amongst others. His music has also been used by various networks and TV shows, including Nickelodeon, NBC, ESPN, Fox Sports, CMT, CBS, NBC, MTV, VH1, The Young and the Restless, Single Ladies, Hollywood Heights, and many more. Those are really all very cool big stuff. As a producer, Shay's worked with several artists and styles ranging from pop to country, rock to R&B, Latin to jazz, amongst others. As an artist, check this out. He's released projects both solo and with bands, both indie and on major label. He has put out 22 albums and EPs, and I would encourage you to check out his website at shaywatson.com, shaywatson.com, and buy his stuff, send him money. He's originally from Alabama, which we won't hold against him because he's really a good guy. And he's been in Nashville since 1998. So, Shay, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man.
This is wonderful.
Congratulations. I'm really excited. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I know you and Klaus just got one of your songs selected to be in the opening scene of a Disney movie with William Shatner.
Oh, yeah. We're very excited about that. You know, we've had a lot of placements, but as soon as they dropped the name Shatner, I thought, hey, that's pretty cool. Grew up with William Shatner, you know, yeah, watching Star Trek and all of his stuff.
What is that movie called and when is it coming out?
Well, it's called Aliens Ate My Homework. It's based on a series of novels that are directed toward teens. And the novels are written by an author named Bruce Colville. And the movie is actually coming out this next year. They haven't had a specific release date yet, but it's actually coming out through Universal. And William Shatner, of course, signed on to it. And I think it's going to be a nice little project. You know, it was very fun writing some of the music for the film, and I look forward to seeing it.
Awesome, man. So when something like that comes out, does that put you guys in a good opportunity? Like when people hear this music, is that really good exposure for you to get other people interested in your work for sync and licensing?
It does. I am always very surprised at what brings attention, and your question is actually twofold. It helps from a standpoint of just building the resume, because every little success adds to the next one, and but the other thing, which I found very interesting, is that there are groups of people who actually search out this music, even though it be background in these TV shows and movies. Some of the music that just passes by very quickly. And I find that I generate a good bit of sales from that. I was surprised. One of the shows that you mentioned that I write for, The Young and the Restless, I often write a lot of background music for that, but sometimes you'll hear a song where either me or someone else is singing into a scene. I always, when I watch television, I would listen and I would think, hey, that's pretty cool, but you're only hearing sometimes 10 seconds of something. That's not a lot of time, but you have groups of avid watchers that actually investigate the music that's played on these different shows and have little chat groups, and they'll go and buy your music. It was very surprising to me. So I'm really happy whenever I get messages. Like this past year, I had a song on the show that called let's see, Something Beautiful, and we wound up playing it in a love scene. And then I got several messages from people who wrote me letters saying they'd used it in their wedding. They had researched, found it, and then gone and used it in their wedding.
Did they send you? Did you tell them to send you a check?
Exactly.
That's very nice. Here's my bill.
Exactly.
Well,
I do think I got a wedding program from someone, but there was no check inside of
right.
it.
Right. I'm sure they take that at Publix. That's awesome, man. That's really cool. It's interesting. You know, it's always. I'm always amazed. At this point in time, I'm not amazed anymore by the. It's almost like, I don't mean this in a sexual way, but fetish-like.
Yeah.
Some of the obscure interests that people have, because they're so like very niched. You know, like you wouldn't think someone's chasing down these songs, but like, obviously they are.
Well, you know, there's a website that often the music supervisors direct us to when we're brought onto a new show that we're not as familiar with, and this website has most shows that you would watch on TV listed by episode, and you can go episode to episode and listen to clips, full clips of the songs that were used in the show. So. Oftentimes when I'm brought onto a new show, they'll say, oh, okay, we'll go on this website and pull it up and listen to it. And you can hear the music. The website's actually called TuneFind. And so I spend a good bit of time on TuneFind.
Yeah, because that's fodder. That's like fodder for you. Idea prompts. That's really good that they have that. I just thought of something. When you got, so you're cranking out, let's call it 1,000 songs a year.
Mm-hmm.
You've obviously got to come up with titles for each of these. I mean, how does that?
Actually, that's very fun for me to do. When it's actual songs, one thing that helps is I get a good bit of direction from the music supervisors on what is needed, and I will write down a list of words that were said to me and a list of moods that they want to evoke. And then what I'll do from there is I will go and circle certain words that just stand out to me. And I'll generally find something that I'll start working off of from there when it's a song. Now, when it's just an instrumental track, I go nuts trying to find the most obscure titles that I can.
So just to make a fun thing out of it. And I guess probably helps you recollect it better. If you called them all some like blank love or blank blues, it would be very redundant at a certain point in time. Not as much fun, I would imagine.
Yeah, it would. But you know something, along the titles, and this just brought something to mind. Last year, as you know, we've spoken before about this when we were first talking about doing the interview. I'm also at the point where in my career where I had a little bit extra income, and I decided to take some law school classes. So so I was doing some criminal law school classes a couple of years ago, and you know, being a full-time working musician, I'm trying to figure out how can I memorize this huge new bunch of knowledge here. I was taking these criminal courses, and I thought, you know, while I'm writing these songs or while I'm writing these tracks for these shows, I'm going to start labeling them as terms that I'm finding in these law books. Like I use probable cause, or I would use this or that. Now, here's the interesting part of that. I was originally writing all of those for just background stuff for Young and the Restless, for YNR. Well, once I started using those terms, criminal mind, mens rea, I started getting them placed in shows that dealt with criminal activity.
Holy smokes.
All of a sudden, I'm getting calls from my supervisor that said, yeah, we just got this whole bunch of songs placed in a show called Snapped, Killer Couples. And then about a week later, I was writing music for Homicide Hunter. And then from there, all of the shows that were murder shows. And I think that the supervisors who were dealing with those shows came across those titles and thought, okay, these are all criminal titles, and wound up listening to them and wanting to use the music in the shows. So I found that very interesting, which, you know, you said you might not want to write them all love this or love that. That's true. You want to make them interesting, but I have been experimenting also with trying to write the mood, whatever mood it is, somehow into the title, and then writing into the title also what type of scene, and I have to be very wise about this, what type of scene that I think it would be played in, because just from seeing how those criminal titles were used, I can take that and apply that to other concepts to see what springs up.
That's so, like, if I were you, man, if I, like, I'm thinking from a marketing standpoint. So what's the longest running, most successful ongoing niche in TV? It got to be doctor hospital shows.
Yeah, man, exactly.
So if I were you, I'd start, you know, nurses dance, or you know,
yeah, or
you know, cardiac arrest, or
there you go, surgery at 11.
Seriously, because you get in that niche, man, you'll be working for the rest of your life.
Dissect my heart.
There you go. I mean, seriously, you'll be working forever. You know, in that niche, that's an endless bounty of music. You know, or else, you know, pick the highest. What are the biggest tickets? And if there's a niche in that, that's what I would do. I would just start boom, boom, boom. That would be an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
That worked. Yeah. That was awesome. But that's good, though, man. That's really cool. Okay. What, man, you're working on so much now. My next question is almost redundant. Is there anything in particular that you're working on now that has you, like, really excited?
There are a couple of things. You know, when I get asked that question, I'm known most now for television. I've been doing I think I got my first television placements probably about 8 years ago, and it started building from there. To where before that, I was known more so as an artist. I was in a few bands myself, and through that, I got to meet a number of different artists on the road that I'd wind up writing songs for their projects, and we'd wind up co-producing stuff together. But now, so that I'm known more for the TV stuff, people forget about some of the artist projects that I'm still working on and producing and writing for. And one that came about recently, this band hasn't been in the limelight for gosh, I think they had their last hit in the late 90s, but I was a huge, huge fan of this band back when I was in college. Is a band called Blessed Union of Souls.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember them.
One of my favorite bands. They, you'd know them from their hits, I Believe, and Hey Leonardo, She Likes Me For Me, just top 10 hits in pop rock market. Well, this past year, I wound up getting acquainted with Elliot Sloan, their lead singer. So they're actually doing a new project that they're going to be releasing, and I've been brought in to write toward the project, and so we've been doing some songs together for that. So I'm very excited. That's about cool, that. Man. It's just because they were one of the bands that I used to listen to so much, and ironically, I joke now, I used to have to play their music at the Holiday Inn in Troy, Alabama, when I was going to school just to get some extra cash. So now it only seems fitting that they should have to play my music.
That's right, man. That's righteous. Absolutely. That's really cool. How did you wind up meeting him?
Through another co-writer of mine, Bill DiLuigi. He's a guy that I've worked with for a long time. One of the absolute best lyricist in Nashville that I've ever met. We've done a lot of stuff in both the country markets and pop market together, and he and Elliot forged a friendship, and then Bill thought, Elliot and Shay would be a great fit to work together. So he introduced us, and we hit it off, and have been writing toward this new project. Just a great guy, too. Elliot's a wonderful guy. I'd really love to see a resurgence in the Blessed Union of Souls career, too.
I'm always so incredibly blown away by the, mutual generosity of, and I don't know if it's a Nashville thing, like does this happen in L.A. and New York, but the mutual generosity, the ongoing nurturing of relationships that artists, I never... And I've spoken to people about this before, that everybody's so willing to help everybody. And the response I typically get is the people that do that are generally the ones that are working steady. And that's why, I guess people's kindness, it comes into play in your success. And I don't know if it's Nashville, maybe, you've been around the world, so you could tell me maybe, is that,
it's, I think with that, that is very true. That is very true what you say, because there's so much talent that's in Nashville. There's so much talent that's in LA and New York that you can choose from, but you're going to work with the people that you want to work with. And I've found over the years, those that I keep on, that I have, that I keep going back to, are those that I would just hang with, that I know are not going to stab me behind my back. Those that I know that during the down times, when the music's not flowing and the money's not good, that they're going to be there.
Right.
And I find that we all surround ourselves with that. And those that are in for the longevity of it, you often find that those people who are not the most generous, who are out for themselves, they usually fall by the wayside. And
which is as it should be, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. But I found that carries over, at least with the people that I've worked with in both New York and LA. It's a different vibe, because you have in Nashville, you have the whole Southern thing. There's a little dance that you have to do in your conversations, and it's a slower pace. But generally, I've found that with the people that I've worked with across the board, with both LA and Nashville, I've enjoyed all these that I've had long term relationships and around the world. Now I've been doing interesting thing. I've started doing a lot of electronic music with producers in the Netherlands and other parts of Europe, Poland, and I've also been doing some work with a DJ producer in Egypt.
Wow.
And
that's really all pretty interesting stuff, man. Yeah,
the interesting thing, though, to me is they have been super, super easy to work with, too. It's been just this brotherhood, you know, that's happened. You know, and I think you have to search those people out and build that collective around you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just the guy that does interviews, and I cannot tell you how literally wonderful everybody has been to me. And I've been, you know, working and doing this for, you know, three, four months, maybe. I don't know. But I'm an outsider, and I feel that. And I see with you guys, I'm like, it's a really nice thing. And I've never seen that before in any, because this is a business, you know, and don't people forget that. I think people outside of it forget that this is a business, and most businesses are not that compassionate and sharing and like, hey, you know, let me, I guess everybody's all about lifting everybody up here. Yeah. And they're actually really willing to go and help lift people up. And that's what's most impressive. And you don't see that. People will help each other in the business world, but I don't think the commitment to is that strong as I've seen here. And it's, you know, it's very nice as an outsider to watch it and, you know, be in a periphery and be exposed to it, to be honest with you. So
yeah,
it's really good. You know, it's interesting. The Netherlands, I listen to a lot of like stoner rock. I'm not a stoner, but they have a massive stoner rock, literally dozens and dozens of, and I'm not talking about the, like the horrible, the, that this, you know, the scary metal guys there, you know, but there's a big stoner rock industry throughout the Netherlands where it's a spawning ground for tons of bands, kind of like how Seattle was in the, you know, 90s for grunge.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Throughout Europe, there's so much music there that we just don't hear over here in the States. And it's very intriguing to me. I've run across genres of music that I didn't even know existed. There was an artist in Germany that I was working with a while back, and she introduced me to a number of groups that are huge in Germany that mix pop rock music with accordion. And as soon as I throw in the term accordion, everyone automatically says polka, but that's not what this was. It was almost like a dark mixing heavy guitars with an accordion played down in the lower register with unusual voices on top, and it just created an interesting feel to it. But you know, along those lines, also I've done some work for a travel channel, and I will get some requests in to hey Shay, can you go and find us some Bavarian pop music with a little bit of, you know, with a little bit of electronica to it. And I'm thinking, you know what? You're just asking me for a hodgepodge of something that doesn't exist. And then I go and I find, oh, this does exist in a huge way over here, you know? So, and that's good for me because I've listened throughout my life to so many different styles of music. There are people that they zero in on one type, you know, like in Nashville, you meet a lot of people that they're country and that's all they're going to listen to. And they can tell you every different facet of the country music, whether it's pop country, old school country, traditional country, bluegrass country, but they don't span out that genre. I've always been someone who, I really love and respect almost every genre of music. There's something I can find that I like in it. And so it's very interesting to me to be in the line where I'm asked to and I'm paid to go and listen to all these types of music. If I had to do one specific type of music for my whole life, like some of my friends do, by some of my friends that only do country or only do pop music, I would feel somewhat like a character actor. Yeah. You know, if you're always pegged as the villain in a movie.
Yeah, I totally get that.
Or if you're always, you know, Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, right. Or always the funny guy. Yeah. Totally. It's hard to break out of that mold.
So I equate it to that. I don't like being a character actor.
That's awesome, man.
And that's the way that I approach music.
Well, you know, and I know I've listened to some, I haven't listened to a lot, but I've been exposed to some of the music from Egypt and like some of the African countries, and some of it's really pretty freaking cool. Like Ethiopian music is really interesting.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I really dig that. And you know, that's really nice that you get to do all that stuff. Originally from Alabama, as I teased you before, but what prompted you to move to Nashville?
You know, I was, when I finished college, I've always known that I wanted to do music. I grew up doing music. I had two brothers that were into music. And, when I was a little kid, I used to gather up the neighborhood kids and build them instruments and teach them what I wanted them doing. I would record it. I have these recordings somewhere on these tape deck recorders of me and all of my friends trying to make music when I was about 7 or 8 years old. But I always knew I wanted to do music. So when I went off to college in South Alabama, there were really, I had only been exposed to a couple of options for what you do if you're a musician. The examples I always had growing up was you were a music teacher, you were a band director, or you worked in church music. That's all I saw. You know, of course, we saw, you know, musical artists and we listened to their albums, but they were so untouchable to us that it didn't dawn on me that I could be one of those guys writing and playing that. I thought, well, you know, I'm going to have to be a music teacher, or I'm going to have to go in church music. So when I went to school, I majored in music education. And I taught 2 years in a private school while I was finishing school. And then after I graduated from college in the mid-90s, I taught 2 years in public school. Absolutely loved it. I loved teaching. I didn't like all the administrative type work that came with it. But at the end of my 2 years, I was teaching at a very small rural school in a farming community in Jack, Alabama, and about as big as it sounds. I was run ragged because I was handling I was the music guy in the town. I was handling the everything from elementary to high school and just keeping crazy hours, and I was getting burned out. You know, as a 21-year-old.
Yeah, that's not.
So at the end of that year, I decided, much to the dismay of my parents and the principal of the school, to not come back the following year. I had 2 great years there, and so I didn't know what I was going to do after that. The world was open at that point. I thought, well, you know, I'm going to have to find a job. But I had some friends in college that had moved up here to Nashville, and they'd been saying, you know, Shay, you're a writer. Come up to Nashville and you know, look around, see how you feel. And I was like, I don't – Nashville, I know. My family's down – everybody's down here. I don't know. I need to think this one out. But I guess Wanderlust and the music got me, and I packed my little Pontiac Grand Am that I had at the time with 2 boxes, and I came and I crashed on a friend's couch for about a month.
Wow.
And the next thing I know, I'm living here and enjoying it. You know, my friend was an engineer. At the time, he was working with Gary Chapman and Gary's ex-wife, Amy Grant. And so I was fortunate enough that he would bring me along some of the sessions. I'd never seen what it was like inside of a music studio before, but I had the opportunity to tag along to some of their sessions and to keep my eyes open, sit quietly in the corner and watch. And it intrigued me. And I thought, you know, this, I could do this. I could really do this. And another buddy of mine, one of our other roommates was also involved in the music industry, but as a performer and going out and playing. And the performance always scared me a little bit at first. But I thought, you know, I'd be very interested to see what I'm capable of if I stay here. So I decided to take up roots here. And that was mid to late 90s when I did that. And ironically, both of the guys who brought me here are no longer here. one of them's out in Vegas. He is doing shows in Vegas. But my other friend, the engineer, he reached that point that some people do, where he just burned out on the music industry. He was working so hard and having deals come through, and then a lot that fell apart, that he just got burnt out from the system. And he's still a good friend of mine, left in a much happier place now, working a corporate job, which is great for him. But that's somewhat of the shortened path to Nashville.
It's funny how, you know, I try to be a good student of life and of human behavior. And one of the things I always get out of these interviews is everybody's story teaches me something or reinforces something. And, you know, in your case, I'm a strong believer in serendipity, mm-hmm. and in the universe helping make decisions for you. Because sometimes you could work and work and work and just slap your head against the wall and nothing's going anywhere. Other times, you know, you do something as you did, and what's the likelihood that you just go into the studio with Amy Grant? I mean, that was in, you know, a silly way, perhaps simplified way of looking at it, but it was meant to be.
Yeah.
You know, the universe supported your decision making to do that, you know, and I think that's really cool, because especially when no matter what you're doing, when you said, man, I didn't know how to do that. And that's a big problem for everybody in almost everything. I mean, unless you're born into something or you happen to be fortunate enough to have somebody, how do you know how to do anything?
Yeah,
exactly. You need either help or a role model or something. And so I'm really glad that, you know, you took that leap of faith, and then, you know, everything else organically very much so fell into place for you.
Yeah. And, you know, it's been very interesting, the route where I am now, because a lot of what I have done and been successful at here, I did not intend to do. Like right after that experience, and this usually I had a publisher. Well, let me back up. There's a publisher from our hometown that had moved up here, been here for 40 years, became very successful. I believe he had worked with Tim McGraw for a while, had a bunch of his songs signed that he owned the rights to. And he was a friend of my dad's growing up, and my dad had kept telling me, go look Charlie up. Charlie Monk's his name. So I, when I got to town, naive, young, green, didn't know, again, what I was even doing here. I went over and looked up Charlie, met with him, and he had said, give yourself 10 years. Nothing's going to happen in 10 years. Nothing. He said, you're going to probably be, eating tuna out of a cat food can because it's cheaper than the regular stuff. But, that was kind of the approach to it. And so I had it in my mind, okay, 10 years, I'm going to give myself 10 years. I'll just kind of hang and watch and learn. But the odd thing is it happened a lot quicker for me. And about a month into being here, just by happenstance, I I'd had a job that they wound up closing the position. I'd wound up taking just a regular job working at one of the schools here in town, and then they wound up doing away with the position. So the day that I was told, "Hey, you don't have a job anymore," I was walking across the campus at this university that I'd been working at. And I saw some kind of information sheet that had some publishers, different publishers information on it. And I thought, you know what? I've got nothing to lose right now. I'm broke. I don't even have a job. I'm just going to start calling people. So I went home, made a phone call. One of the first guys on that sheet said, "Okay, come over for a meeting." And
you're like, holy shit, this works.
Yeah, I was not expecting that. So I went over, and we wound up hitting it off on a personal level. He was from small town Mississippi. I was from small town Alabama.
Very cool.
Much similar backgrounds in the stories of our families. And it was a nice meeting, but I thought, you know, I didn't have a lot of material to even bring here. And so a couple of days later, I was actually in bed sleeping late, and my phone rang. And I looked over, and it was this publisher. And I picked up the phone, you know, and
you can try to get rid of that morning voice. Yeah. I've been up since 5 doing a bunch of work.
and all he said was, "Hey, you know, I was just thinking about you today. I'm over here at the Longhorn Steakhouse. You want to join me for lunch?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'll be there in a minute.
Be right down."
So I hopped out of bed, got ready as quick as I could, and we talked. And he said, "You know," he said, "one thing that I noticed about you when we were having our meeting is you're very open and you have a teachable spirit. A lot of people who have come in here that have brought me their songs, they're so adamant and hardcore about not changing or doing that or having a bad attitude about something that I've said, but you were not that. You were very open to it, and I would like for us to continue conversation." So we continued conversation. He wound up giving me a job there, just sort of filing papers and stuff around the publishing office. They were also connected to a small label at the time, and had launched they hadn't launched him. He was a artist that had former success that they wound up launching a new single on him and taking him to number 2 on the Christian charts. And so I was there to witness that. I was still doing the paperwork, but a part of the trade was I'd get a little stipend of money, enough to pay for this little tiny apartment that I was living in, and I could watch the writing sessions of the other writers.
Paid tuition in this. He was allowing you to learn, paid tuition, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so what I did was I would go home at night, go back to my apartment, and I would literally lock myself in, and I would stay up until about 2 or 3 in the morning writing, taking all of these approaches that I saw these guys do. And then I started bringing in my ideas to this publisher, and he was like, "Man, you're really coming up with some great stuff here."
Now, hold on a second. When you said, were you writing songs, lyrics, or both?
Songs. Okay, I was writing lyrics and melodies. Okay. And I was always a melody top guy, but he recognized my potential more as a lyricist, because he said melody writers are a dime a dozen here. You know, you can find a lot of great musicians who can write great melodies, but finding that marriage of someone who can write a great lyric, that's a more of a rarity. So what happened was one of the other writers was not meeting his quota, and I was meeting everybody's quota.
Sure, yeah.
Because I was killing myself doing it. So he wound up offering me probably, I would say, by the end of that year, I had a songwriter's deal with the company. It was small. I mean, it was, I think I probably only got like, you know, $600 a month, for doing that at the time. But, you know, that was, the late '90s, and, I was young and living by myself. I had to get another part-time job. It's funny, I was waiting tables, for at night. And then I was going in and working and writing at this publishing company during the day. So I had those two worlds that I was trying to balance. But
not uncommon for musicians at all. No,
not uncommon at all. Not uncommon at all. But yeah, so I wound up getting some of my first cuts in the Christian music market through that world. And I was what they had wanted was 40% country music from me and about 60% the Christian market, because that was the market that they were having a lot of success in at the time. So those were some of my earlier cuts. But while I was there working at the publishing company / label, they introduced me to a new writer artist that they had just started working with named Jacob Wiley. And I was completely geared toward just the songwriter end of things. It didn't even dawn on me to be an artist. I didn't really want to be an artist. I just wanted to be a writer. But Jacob and I started booking shows together as a duo.
We were out on the town.
Okay. Broadway
shows, or
we would play at some of the places down there, but we would really play at anywhere that would have us.
Sure.
And we found that we were sounding good, and we were getting a nice feedback from our audiences. So I booked a few shows out of town. Then we go out. We were down in Louisiana, and we played a show there. And after the show, one of his loose connections that he had had growing up, that was a musician, a singer, and a mandolin player, wound up coming up to us and talking to us. And it turns out the 2 days later, he moved to Nashville, and we formed a group called 10 Mile Drive.
Right. Okay.
Out on the road for 4 years together as that group. And we did something that I don't think it can be done as much these days. We, our first year out on the road, we were making decent money, but we weren't making great money. But we got up to the point where we were playing 150 shows a year.
By that second, you were booking all these shows, you personally?
Yeah, we were me and the three of us, we were just booking. But what was crazy is this was pre iTunes also. You gotta keep
sure,
this from a merchandise
pre digital.
Yeah. We were going out, we were having sold out shows, and we were selling to 7 to 10 out of every 10 people that were there in the audience, we would sell 7 CDs.
That's a great conversion.
We were selling.
Which is really probably close to 100%, because people don't go to shows alone.
Yeah, right. But we were bringing in $20,000 a week.
Yeah, I believe that. Just in merch.
Three guys going out in
wow.
merch. And it was so we formed it. It's a very unique group. It's like we used Beach Boy-esque.
Yeah, so hold on a second. Let me just work the numbers. That's $1 million a year.
Yeah.
Correct? Yeah, yeah. So that's phenomenal. Let me just say, I hate to interrupt, one quick question, and you don't have to answer it now, but put it in the back burner. When you first said to me, I booked a show out of town in Louisiana, how do you know, why Louisiana? Why not, Florida? Why not? Like, so I'm curious. Just keep that on the back burner. Like, how did you know this club? How does that work? I don't know that.
You know, sometimes it's our early bookings were shots in the dark. It was literally just I was trying to find festivals online, and I was just throwing darts at anything that I could.
All right. So you just called and say, hey, I heard about your club. It sounds like we'd be a good fit. This is what we do.
Yeah.
You guys interested in hiring us for Saturday night 2 weeks from today or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay. That's simple. Interesting. Very cool.
But the cool thing about that group is very unique group, and I think it was kind of cross generational too, because we played pop songs with tight harmonies. We all sang, but we did it to bluegrass instruments, so we could get booked almost anywhere. But where we wound up getting our most bookings were at universities, which was great because you're hitting your core audience. Are those that are the 18 to 21 year olds, and they and they're graduating, and then they're going on to other things, and then they're requesting you to come play at their events. We wound up getting a lot of clubs, corporate events, festivals. It just mushroomed for us, and there was a comedic element also to what we did on stage, although we were not a comedy act by any means. But it was is very different from what you. We put on a show. We were
entertainers.
We would entertain. We were entertainers with great music, and. But what wound up happening with that is at the end of our about 3.5 years, we had labels that came to us. We had 5 labels that brought offers to the table. We had Warner, Curb. We were talking
Holy about smokes.
Old Boy Records. We had the big guys and small guys, and we wound up signing a deal with an imprint of Sony Music. Now, and this factors into if you ever ask me what one of the biggest successes and biggest failures at the same time was, it would be 10 Mile Drive, because the group should have been huge. But we got into the studio, we're making our album, and then that's when the industry mechanism hit, and it wound up pulling us apart and doing away with the band. Just a long story short, we were pressured to let go. We had brought on a staff. You know, when you're bringing in as much money as we were,
you have to.
And they no longer wanted a lot of our staff members around. Some of them that had been there with us for a while, and we were opposed to letting them go. You're trying to make these big business decisions in your 20s, and we made some bad business decisions. We let some people go that shouldn't have been let go, and then lawsuits were brought up because everybody had different ownerships in it, and we wound up having to get out of our deal, and we could not play together as the entity of 10 Mile Drive for a 5-year period of time. Oh. Well, you know what a 5-year period of time will do to a fan base.
It's like 100 years, man.
You're done.
Yeah.
So we saw we're done. we're done. And that's where the industry comes in. But you know, when you, this refers back to an earlier question, the people that you have around you, that was a very dark period for me, because when we lost our label deal, a lot of those that had been around us telling us how great we were and how, we'd be with you through thick and thin, a lot of them fell away. They were not there anymore. Yeah. But the phone stopped ringing at that point. But there were a few that were authentic. There was one writer in particular who's a phenomenal writer. He's had some huge hits here in town. His name's Jerry Sally. I remember right after we lost our deal, I was driving back from South Alabama around Christmas time. And he called me on my cell phone, said, "Hey, man, I just wanted to check and see how you were doing." You know, and guys like that.
Yeah, man. Sometimes a call like that, you just need it at the right time. It makes you feel like $1 million. It makes all your problems go away almost.
And that's true. And, I think it's someone like him who has had hit after hit, and still has a phenomenal career in the music industry. He's still around. Some of those guys that were brought in that were the younger riders that no longer called us back, I can look on my hand and tell you one guy owns a athletic club now. He got out of the music industry, didn't last. Another guy is working, another dude is doing graphic design. They're not in the music industry anymore. And I think it's those things, those that are supportive, that stay with you through the thick and thin, they're there. They have longevity. Those that are in it for the moment, they're in it for the moment.
Yeah, right. That's an amazing story, man. Thank you for sharing that. I would imagine if you're bringing in 20 grand in merch a week, probably 90% of your time at that point had to be facilitating that process, inventory and ordering and all that, and shipping. And that's not an easy job.
Yeah, we were we wound up having about five or six people that were that we were paying to work for us, doing things that we just no longer could do, and we were signed with a management company who managed them and us. Gotcha. So it wound up becoming very much so a business. But you know, after we lost the deal, we had so much payouts. I literally went from having really good money in $1.5 million record deal to going about 30 grand in debt all right there within the same 6 month period. Now fortunately, I was able to come out of all of that relatively unscathed, because what was interesting is a number of groups we had toured with, I started getting phone calls from those artists and some of the groups that were doing their albums that wanted me to write toward their album or work with them on some level on the album. And I would get called into these projects, and from the writing standpoint, it was great, because this was before iTunes took full effect, and we were still making decent money even if you wrote B-sides on projects. So that really pulled me out of my hole there. I fell back onto what I originally started with when I was in town, which was writing, which was the songwriting.
And it's not just a financial hole. It's an emotional, like, man, you just feel, because I've had this happen to me in business. You just feel like, worthless is a dramatic word, but you just feel like.
It's an appropriate word, though.
Yeah. You don't, right. You kind of feel worthless. You're not worth. It's just like, it's a down feeling, man. You're like, what the hell have I, you know, especially if you've done it. You know, I always, one thing, and I'm sure you have seen this, the people who have worked really hard to become successful, I have found, I grew up in a very, you know, lower income, and I didn't ever meet anybody successful. But the only thing I heard about was successful people, they're all crooks. You know, the same message that most broke people hear when they're growing up, because, you know, it's just, that's the culture. And I have found the exact opposite. The guys who've worked really hard are generally the nicest people in any profession. You know, you work really hard. You have no reason not to be happy and nice, because you feel comfortable. You feel very emotionally satisfied that the fruits of your labor, you feel good that you could help other people.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the people that sort of like, I've had stuff handed to them. Those are the guys that are like, you know, a little bit out of control, I find.
Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. And I think that's across the board in any sort of profession.
That's an interesting segue into a part of what we're facing in our music industry right now that I found, and it relates back to well, first of all, technology's always there are benefits to it, but it's always going to screw over the artist in some aspect, which is somewhat what happened when Napster first came out and iTunes. People were no longer buying physical product. They were buying single songs. So there was less money on the table. So what wound up happening that I've seen is that you had, and this isn't in every case, but this is in a good number of cases that I've seen lately is because there's less money on the table, those that are able to do music, those that are able to get the deal, are those that have some type of backing, whether it's from a wealthy family or whether it is from you know, a friend of mom and dad's that were big investors. So you have this thing that's happening to a degree where those that have money are able to play, and those that don't are having a harder time at it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you're always going to experience that in any facet, in any industry to a degree, but I've really seen it a lot lately in music, just because the music industry is so expensive. To launch an album, it's almost to get even a dent where people listen to you, it's going to cost $1.5 million to $2 million these days, with the radio promotions, with you know, everything that goes with that, the marketing,
sure,
the projects. So I've had a lot of artists lately. Now, fortunately, a lot of the artists that I've worked with, this hasn't been their situation. There have been some that have been fortunate to have backing to them, but fortunately for them, they're good people and they're very, very talented people. But I have seen some of my friends that have called and told me just horror stories of getting these artists who have, you know, seemingly endless funds into the studio, and then the artist just can't pull it off from a songwriting perspective, or even from a playing and singing perspective. So that's something that's a little bit scary to me. And I've noticed that some of them are able to get label deals, because when you're bringing, you know, when you bring
a couple of million bucks to the table, yeah,
then yeah, who's not going to sign
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
But
and just to, let me clarify for the listeners. What Shay's talking about now is not the musicians. He's talking about artists who are quote-unquote songwriters and have musicians playing on their albums, whether they be studio musicians or touring musicians. But I just wanted to clarify that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. The funny thing is, you still have and again, this is not I don't want to put that on everyone that, sure, that has been able to do that, because there have been a number of great artists that have had a good bit of backing and brought it to the table, and they're able to also bring it from a musicianship, sure, or an entertainment standpoint. But it's something that I think that the music industry just needs to be aware of. It puts it in a framework where, in order to play the game of being an artist, you either have to not have a mortgage or any responsibilities at all, which is going to put you in that framework of being your early 20s. So you're only going to have so much depth to your music that you're going out and playing, or you're going to be someone that has a lot of money to bring to the table and finance getting your music heard. Those are two examples of what we're seeing a lot of in the music industry. Because I get asked that the question all the time: Why do we hear the same thing over and over? Why are we why is music today doesn't seem like it used to be from a craft standpoint? And these are all factors that play in it. It's sort of the society that we've set up for ourselves.
Well, it's I think a lot of it is technology, like you said. Yeah. I mean, it's just
it is. It starts with technology, but then it filters down from there.
It's interesting because I interviewed, you know who Jerry McPherson is?
I've heard the name, yes.
So he's an A-list.
Oh, yeah.
First call guy. And I asked him, what do you dislike the most about your business? And he said he referred to it as song triage, where, you know, triage is like when you go into the emergency room in a hospital, right? And they have a triage nurse prioritizing, you know, who gets seen first. And he called it song triage because he said so many times you know, he gets him and the other guys in the studio, if they're lucky enough to have other guys in the studio on that particular, yeah. and something comes in and it's like, you know, dog shit. And he's got to like, you know, and you know, the truth is you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit sometimes, you know,
yeah.
you can't, yeah. you know, the old expression, you can't polish a turd. And he said, I absolutely hate it. It's unfair. And then, so he and the studio guys wind up having to breathe life into something that, you know, probably shouldn't have had been brought in there in the first place. So I totally understand that. And it's something I consistently hear. And what's interesting is when I talk to musicians and I ask the question, what do you like most about your job? 90%, literally, maybe 95% of the answers I get is just the fact that I get to do this for a living and get paid for it. I mean, I'm just overjoyed. So I, you know, it goes back to that earlier question we talked about, you know, the quality of the people and the, you know, the gratitude and the appreciation and stuff like that. So, yeah, I understand. But at least you're doing something now. And I understand why more people, because you'd think, you know, what you're doing is one of the few bastions left.
Yeah, this is true.
You don't have to worry about somebody buying your music and downloading it versus bootlegging it. I mean, sure, you're solo work, but you're the bulk of your time now you're spending in sync and licensing.
Yeah.
You know,
and really that was the injection that kept me alive.
Yeah.
Because after the success and then I don't know if I would call it failure, but you know, we failed to launch of the first band that I mentioned.
With 10 Mile Drive.
Yeah, 10 Mile Drive. When I came back to the scene, I started a country duo with a friend of mine, Joe Nash. And we went out on the road for about 3 years together. And I couldn't understand why I could understand. I didn't realize how bad it was that product was not, you know, that sales were so down. It just surprised me because I was used to
walking, selling 20 grand a week
and just selling, everybody coming up after show buying an album. And the album that Joe and I, that Watson and Nash put out, we were very proud of it. It was in many respects better than what I had done with 10 Mile Drive's work. And our show was exciting. And plus, one of the big songs off of that album was a song called Bring It On, which wound up getting picked up by Fox and ESPN for their game days for college football. So we had that extra marketing there. So we were going out playing bigger shows, better shows, and then we weren't selling product. And it was just kind of blowing my mind what was happening here. And I would ask my other artist friends, and it was kind of like that. Well, Shay, while you were gone for that period of – I was never gone, but while you were writing and producing and doing those chops before you reformed, when you left the gigging on the road for that period of time, a lot changed, because that is when, you know, I think we, at least in Nashville, started feeling the effects of what iTunes had done to the industry. It was bringing it back to a single song, industry. And Watson and Nash, from that great experience, and we got to the point too where we were getting the label offers on the table, but in the end, we decided that wasn't what we wanted our next 20 years to look like. We didn't want to be going out and having to just have that constant struggle of investing your money into doing these projects that no one was going to buy. And what had happened at that time, as I mentioned, one of the big songs from our album had gotten licensed to Fox and ESPN. Well, from that licensing, it prompted some other business for me in the TV sync world, and I started seeing how much money was coming in off of that, and I thought, gosh, you know what? You're getting older now. You've been out on the road a lot. You're getting to that point where you want to start a family.
Sure.
The money's here. The money is not here anymore. And you can always do music, but if you're going to maintain a profession where you're supporting your family,
sure,
you need to get that aspect of the industry where the money is. So that's when I really started just focusing 90% of my time into sync and television licensing. And a lot of the stuff that I learned on the road with both of those groups, I brought over, because I was at heart, I'm a keyboard player. I was my first primary instrument was piano, but I never played that in any of the groups that I've been in.
What did you play usually? Guitar, acoustic?
I sang and played bass in 10 Mile Drive. I was an upright bass player, and I would also play accordion in the group. When I was in Watson Nash, I played guitar, and that was primary instrument that I did. So having to practice every single day on both of those instruments and become as proficient at them as I was at piano, that really
has made
me in the TV and film area to be able to pick up an instrument and just, you know, do it.
Nothing's ever wasted as a creative. That's one thing I know I've learned, and obviously I'm sure you've more than learned that, so it's good. It turns out great. Yeah, because I'm sure you had, by the time you had Watson and Nash, they're you're singing and they're on their computers going into Pirate Bay. Man, I need to get this CD. Well, that's what it's like. You know, I hate to say it, but that's what it's like.
But it's great now, because I get up in the mornings, I put on a cup of coffee, come in here, talk to my rep, and most of the people that I work with, ironically, when you said you don't have to depend on the record industry, I really don't. I live in Nashville. I love Nashville, but most of my work is from the West Coast.
Right.
I get assignments, and I do them and I turn them in, and I've been in a very good place these past few years. I've really enjoyed this.
Well, you've earned it, man. You've worked hard for it. I'm happy for you.
Thank you.
Awesome. Hey, man, this is a great story. I could ask you a million questions. If you could give advice to your younger self, because now that you've had this book of experience, what advice do you think you would have given?
You know, don't get so tunnel vision toward one thing that you miss other opportunities. Be open to different possibilities. But even though I was open, there were times within that I would get very tunnel vision. Like I'd mentioned, I didn't intend to be an artist, but once I got into being an artist and playing, then the focus was placed on the record deal.
Right.
It was always on music, but it was, you know, when you need to take it to that next level and maintain, the focus shifts to, okay, we've got to do this. And then you miss a whole lot of things in the periphery. So it would just be to be open to the possibilities of what all is out there musically.
Sure. Let me ask you some personal questions. Man, honestly, I could talk to you for hours. It was such an interesting story. Thank you for sharing that. Who were some of your biggest musical influences?
You know, I have I listen to so much music, but coming up, when I was younger, I was fortunate enough that I was the last child born in our family. So I inherited, and my parents were in their 40s when they had me, and they were teenagers back in the 50s. So I inherited all of their 45s.
My first
music that I was listening to was Elvis and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and those groups. Now, my brothers, they were 14 and 12 years older than me, so I got all the 60s and the 70s from them. So I had all the Beatles albums, I had everything from the Animals, Loving Spoonful, the Carpenters, a lot of these groups that just had such a high degree of musicianship and sure. great songs and great melodies. Yeah. And then I inherited their albums from the 70s, and there was just so much great stuff going on in the 70s. Yeah. And then I was, of course, a child of the late 70s, early 80s.
Sure.
So I was there were just so many influences. But Billy Joel was
I was going to say, how about keyboards? That's what was, yeah,
they were two that I attached to early on when I started buying my own music. My first
Billy Joel and who else? I'm sorry.
Elton John, okay. But more more so Billy Joel. I was a huge, I was such a huge Billy Joel fan. When I'd get my allowance from cutting grass or whatever it was my parents had me do, they gave me like $2 a week. I would save up and I'd save up that money and I would go and buy a Billy Joel album.
Sure.
And I wound up buying having every one of his albums from Cold Spring Harbor, like his yeah. first one that no one knew about,
yeah.
the way to whatever, you know, present day was. And I would devour those. Such a great songwriter.
Tremendous. Yeah.
Such great production in there. Also, you know, so that was probably my biggest influence as a kid and as a teenager. But when I shifted my teenage years, I started listening to a lot of musicals. I had a guy that was our music teacher that moved to town that was a composer. He's actually now sold. He wound up leaving that, and he's known as a composer, but he mentored me and exposed me to a lot of music that was outside of the, you know, the typical pop radio. Sure. Stuff that you'd listen to. So I got huge into listening to different musicals that were coming out. And then Sting's big influence too. Love Sting. Then when I moved here to Nashville, I got into the country scene for a while, and I'd listen to Colin Ray from a country standpoint, and Garth Brooks, that they were influences. I'm always a pop rock guy at heart.
Sure. Well, those three guys, Billy Joel, Elton John, and Sting, I'm extremely familiar with all their music. Those are very creative writers. They're not, you know, three chords and out. You know, those are very musical.
And that's really what attracted me too, is I was always just drawn to different textures chordally.
Yeah.
You know, you don't experience that a lot with a lot of the music that I'm hearing that's coming out these days. You do in certain genres, but you know, a lot of it we're back to, you know, if I can, the times that I've heard the 1-4-6-5-5
yeah, there you go.
Over and over, and I can take, you know, this melody and implant it on top of this song. Gosh, how many more times? And you know, it's funny, you find trends quarterly that happen at different periods of time. And but yeah, part of my attraction to them was all those different textures from the chords and melodies that I would hear. Peter Gabriel too, yeah. big influence.
Really creative songwriter. You are married, correct?
Yes.
And you have a couple of kids.
Yep, two kids. I've been married for this next year will be 18 years.
Man, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
That's awesome.
We dated for 4 years before we got married, so we've been
22 years, man. Congratulations. How'd you all meet?
We were in the this is such a nerdy sound, but we were in the marching band together at the university.
Hey, man, that's great. Good for you. Yeah, do that over 100 times, I'm sure.
But yeah, we delayed having children for many years because I was on the road and I wanted to be there, you know, to when we did have kids. So we have now a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. So I'm in my 40s with a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old.
Yeah, but you know what? You like when I had started having kids, I had my first at 26, my last at, I guess, 36. And simply because you're older, you're more, you know, there's certain qualities that as a dad, like patience, you probably have a much more available than it. Like I know I was much more patient and understanding for my third at 36. Now some of that's a function of, man, just as long as you're not like, you know, swallowing knife blades, you know, because it's like, you know, you just don't have the bandwidth, because by the time the third comes around, it's like, oh, you know, but much of it is just your understanding of, you know, what they need. You're not as, not selfish, because I'm not a selfish person, but you're more, your awareness of what they need is higher, and your understanding and capacity to, you know, to do it is much higher, I think, at an older age. So, you know, there's a positive to everything, you know? So, well, that's good. Congratulations. 22 years together. That's nice, man. The marching band. That'll be one of the bullets. Find out how Shay met his wife in the marching band. What would you consider your biggest business win so far? And I think you've had many.
You know, I'm not sure how to answer that one exactly, because I've had highlights throughout the years, but you know, I think it just all culminates to where we are now. I think I'm having a lot of wins these days, but I don't know if I could point to one in particular. I thought that the 10-mile drive landing the record deal was a win, and then it wound up not being, but that was huge at the time. And then, you know, another win was when I helped to write the first Sidewalk Prophets album. They wound up getting a lot of exposure with that, winning a Dove Award for the album. And that was another win that was unexpected, that yielded some songs that I have that really meant a lot to me. I remember I was playing I wrote a song called Moving All the While, and I was playing a writer's night one night, and this other writer who was in the circle with me, and I won't mention his name, but because you'd probably know him, but he looks over. I'd just played that song. I'd been playing all these country songs, and I looked over at him, this guy that I really respect, and I'm sitting there listening to his songs thinking, man, if I could do as well as you're doing. And I noticed tear come to his eye, and and he started singing along on this song that I had written. And I get to the end of the song, and it's coming around his time. He said, "Before I play my next song, I need to tell you a story." He said, 3 years ago, I went through one of the most nasty divorces and had, you know, thought about basically killing myself at the time. A friend of mine gave me that album that had that song on it.
Wow.
And that song pulled me out.
Man, I got goosebumps. You just said that, man. That's awesome.
And those are the moments that, you know, you look at the industry we're in, of course, from a financial perspective, you're happy about those wins, and you're happy when you get the big song on the radio, or the big song in the film. But then when you take it to that level, you're reminded why you do what you do.
Yeah, man. And that's the song was what was the song called?
Moving All the While.
Moving All the While. It's on Sidewalk Prophets.
Sidewalk Prophets, the Simple Truths album. I wrote a few of their songs that I was friends with those guys before they had their deals, and we made a lot of music together. But that's awesome. That's one that I'm really proud about. And that actually came out of a dark time for me. I was supposed to be on this was shortly after the 10-mile drive losing out on a lot of finances. I remember I walked out one morning. Somebody had run into my car And there were just a number of things going on. I wound up having to sell this house I was in, and me and my wife and our two animals moved. Not my kids.
No, you know what? They're too young for you to be referring to them as animals yet. Yeah. I didn't. Yeah, give it a few years, man. You got a few years before you'll be referring to them as animals.
But we moved into a tiny one-bedroom apartment, and I was going out on tour with a friend of mine that was doing a solo thing. He used to be in a group called Sonic Flood, which was a pretty big band, and we were about to leave to go on tour, and he calls me, and his ex-wife had a link to the account that all of our band money was in. It was no longer in there. Yeah. So we wound up having to I couldn't go out on the road with them. So I'm there. I'm out of work during this time. And so I started booking some shows of my own. Well, I wound up getting this virus that attacked my vocal cords where I could barely speak for about 2 months. So couldn't do any shows. I'm stuck there. I'm thinking I've got to go get I've got to find something to bring some income in. Go outside. A tree has fallen on my car.
Holy crap, man.
So I'm just stuck. I'm stuck. I can't do anything but be on the back porch of this one-bedroom apartment. And then my friends, Ben and Dave from Sidewalk, called me up, and they said, hey, we just got signed, and we're doing this album. We want you to help us write it. I'm like, hey, I would love to, but you got to come to me. Because I can't go anywhere right now. And so they came over, and we sat on my back porch, me in one of the most negative mindsets that I had been in, and that song was birthed out of all of that. And from that, I've had, other stories like the one that I told you that have just come up from that. Song, and what song wound up going into a print and being a international thing in the Christian music community. So that was,
go figure.
That's kind of a cool thing. Yeah. Another win recently also, an artist named Lauren Elizabeth, who's a country artist, Nine North Records. I discovered her when she was about 15 or 16 years old. And I started writing for her then, and later with her as she grew into her own as a writer. We wound up getting a label deal for her, and I produced three of her albums. And just this past year, we spent 16 weeks on the Billboard charts in country music with our song "To Be Young." So that's one I'm very proud of.
That's awesome, man.
Because it's one that I feel that I had a hands on from the very beginning all the way up to taking her from that to Billboard.
I want to point out something, that the only way any of this happened is because you kept getting up to take to the plate, man. I mean you're talking about some of the hits and people are listening, wow, he's man. You're writing 1,000 songs a year just on this one project now. Well, not one project, but just on your sync business.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in the mix of all these other hits, I would probably be conservative if I said there was probably at least another 2,000 songs written. Is that a fair estimate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's easy to sit and for someone to listen and say, oh, man, that's a lot of, you're batting percentage, but it doesn't. I have this thing on my wall that says there's only three reasons you'll not be successful, because everybody gets down, and I get down just the same as everybody else in business sometimes. Number one, you don't try new things. Number two, you don't learn from what you try. Or number three, you give up. You just didn't give up, man. And that's why all this shit happened. It's awesome, man. That's just some great stories. Shay, I'm going to ask you three more questions. I want to be mindful of your time. Number one, what's the best advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
Oh gosh, best advice. That's I really do think that the advice that I was given early on of you're going to be here for 10 years before you see anything happen. That was good advice, even though it wasn't exactly my story. It kind of gave me that extra push to say, hey, you had some success before then, and keep going. This is very hard for people. I think that's a good advice. And, you know, the advice to, you know, just after these failures, just get up and keep pushing through them, no matter how difficult and bad you feel. Yeah. Just keep going, keep moving, keep moving.
Well, I think that advice was probably so valuable to you because of something we talked about before the call started, is managing expectations.
Yeah.
And that probably set a very good barometer for you to say, well, you know what? You know, I'm not 10 years into this thing yet, or I've had, like you just said, it allows you to feel good because you've had some highs, but, you know, okay, you've made that, mentally and emotionally, you've made that commitment and you're sticking to it. And I could see why that was so valuable to you, man.
Yeah.
You do a lot of charity work. Do you want to talk about any of that?
You know, I have done a good bit. I used to be a spokesperson for a Mission of Mercy. I'm not with them anymore, but I'm always promoting this, and I still do promote this. But they're an organization much like World Vision and Compassion International that provide funding for children in impoverished areas of the world. I'm always promoting and saying that. The kids in these situations, you think of the worst situations you could be in this country, and then multiply. That's what these kids are in. And when you take a small portion of your income and give toward their education, you're making a huge difference, not only for those kids, but for the villages that they're from. When they find out a kid's being sponsored, they throw huge parties in the villages because they know, much unlike a lot of people here where we're brought up to go make something of yourself, go to the university and leave, and you often leave your hometown and don't come back. Well, you have a kid that is fortunate enough to be sponsored and go through that program. They go through their elementary school years, their high school years. I supported one kid all the way up until he was about 18 or 19, and I started when he was 5.
Wow.
And I've sponsored a number of kids throughout the years, but they often come back to their villages and feed back into it and make life better.
Very cool.
So I encourage people in that area, whether it's through a World Vision or a Compassion or Mission Mercy, to look into that, at least look into it.
Good. Thank you, man. One last question, tough question. What's your definition of happiness?
I'm still figuring it out.
Yeah. Well, aren't we all? And it changes day or week by week, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You know, I find a lot of, you know, just when you have hope, there's a certain degree of joy about you. I think people perish for lack of having any hope. And, you know,
that's a very true statement for sure.
Yeah.
For sure, man. Hey, listen, man, you're a wonderful guy, man. Honestly, it has been a real pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate you sharing everything. And
thanks for talking to me.
I'm so happy that, you know, you're in a good spot now and things are really going well for you and Klaus. Everybody, just listen to and check out Shay Watson, Shay, SHAYWATSON.com. He's just a great guy. He's a very genuine person. I've gotten to know him a little bit outside of this call, and he's a very, very sweet guy. And he's got a great work ethic, and, you know, he's busting his ass and doing some good stuff for musically and his family and all that, and just in the community. Anything you want to promote or?
You know, I would encourage, you know, if people want to learn more about my music, just go to my website. I have links to Spotify and a lot of places where you can find my music, and iTunes and other projects that I'm working with, a number of the artists that I've talked about, they're great artists, great people, and I have links to them on my website, so feel free just to go there and awesome. Check it out.
But don't listen, don't stream. Just send them buy them some money. What's CD's 10 bucks? Come on, man. You should pay him just for the time he spent here listening. He's telling everyone all his cool stories. Listen, everybody, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview. This is a lot of fun, really interesting. And as a reminder, if you want to check out Shay's writing partner, Klaus Luchs, I interviewed him in episode 28. Another really, really cool guy, very genuine guy. And so listen to that. Again, it's episode number 28. Shay, thanks again so much, man. I really appreciate
Thank you.
This, and I genuinely
Thank
enjoyed it. Everybody, go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes of the podcast, along with some other cool new things we'll be doing for guitar players. Now, be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. And till next time, I am out. Peace, y'all. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.